We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Hello, I'm Cleta Mitchell. Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast about all things having to do with elections, how elections are supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do about that. And today we're honored to have a very special guest, someone who has an experience that I don't think there's another person in America who has this experience. And that is Elizabeth Butler. And she is someone who was involved in building election integrity work in Virginia in 2021 and now lives in Florida and has carried on and is doing election integrity work in Florida. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking time to join us. I know you're very busy working on post-election matters in Florida and possibly even in Georgia. So thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Cleta, for having me. And thank you for all the work that you and all of your team are doing. We need the support from you so much. And it's really wonderful to know that we're all working together and pulling in the same direction.
Well, we appreciate that. And it's been just a pleasure to get to know and watch you and all that you do. And I want to just sort of dive right in. Tell everybody a little bit about Elizabeth Butler. Who are you? Let's start with when you were in Virginia, where you lived and what you were doing there before we talk about Florida. So tell us a little about you, Elizabeth.
Well, a little bit about me. I am basically a retired soccer mom. I have time on my hands because both my kids are in college, and I was trained as an engineer and then also worked in management consulting. And so I have a lot of process experience. Like, I think in processes. And so when I was introduced to the election world, the world of poll watching, it to me was this very exciting process with all of these different things to learn about. And I just basically couldn't hold myself back. And my brain started mapping out diagrams of how the ballots flowed and all of that. So I'm just sort of naturally drawn to it, but I've always been interested in politics. So it's a good like mesh of the two things that I love.
Well, you know, you're giving voice to what I always say at the beginning of the podcast. It's about elections, how they're supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be run, and what citizens can do about it. So tell us about you. You were living in Virginia. Tell us about how you were drawn to the election integrity effort in Virginia in the first place.
So I first started poll watching in 2015. And was sort of recruited in by a friend of mine on my local political committee that was serving on an electoral board, and she just needed help and wanted me to go and watch a particular polling place. And
that was in where? Where was that?
That was in Richmond, Virginia, in the Capitol.
Okay.
So I dutifully went, and like everybody who poll watches for the first time, was completely overwhelmed, had no idea what I was looking at, but realized that there was all this law and rules that are set up by the state that you can learn about, and you can start to figure out what they're doing and what makes sense. And in the process of just watching that day, I saw a lot of strange things happening. This was a college precinct, so it's not, it kind of makes sense, but kids that would come up to vote, and sometimes for the first time, and they didn't even know what their address was.
Because
they move constantly. You know, they don't get mail at college, and so they're writing their address on things, and they're moving constantly. But if you don't know where you live, it's very difficult to know if you're voting in the right precinct. So, you know, that's just, you know, one extreme, but it's that kind of thing that I watched and said, hey, this shouldn't be this hard. You know, how can we, you know, understand the system and work within the system to make it better for everybody? So that's was sort of how I got started in 2015, and then very quickly figured out I needed to recruit a bunch of other people to help me and to watch all of these locations. And so we were there, you know, through 2016, through, you know, waking up the morning after 2016 and not you know, really knowing exactly what had happened and whether there were problems or not. All of that we witnessed. So when, you know, fast forward to 2021, we've been in Richmond, had been kind of chipping around the edges of election integrity. We didn't call it that, but that's basically what it was, making sure the laws were followed. And in 2021, we found out that there were people around the state that were doing the same thing. I had never met these people before, but I was invited to participate in a call and discovered that there were people just like me in a lot of other big localities in Virginia. And that was a great day. That was a great day, the day that I learned that we were all going to help each other get up the learning curve of election integrity. And it's been a really great experience, just the quality of the people that I've met, including you, and just the enthusiasm of, you know, folks that are involved in this process, because they want to make it easy to vote, because we all, you know, have a cherished vote, and they want it to make, want to make it hard to cheat. They want to know that the election is fair and free.
So, Elizabeth, I've heard you tell a story, several stories, because you spoke at a number of our statewide election integrity summits, not just in Virginia, but in other places. And the audience always loved hearing your stories. I know I certainly have always loved hearing your stories. But you talked about something, I'm trying to remember the one story that you told about how you woke up in the night and you were thinking through the process related. Was it absentee ballots? What exactly? I'm trying to remember that story and how you went back to the polling place and talked to the election officials and about their process. Do you know which story I'm thinking of?
There's so many, because once you start thinking like this, your brain just, when you're relaxed, your brain starts to assemble all of the pieces. So I'm not sure exactly what story that is, but there are many of them.
Well, think of one that you can give us an example of a way that you saw something and maybe thought about it later and talked to the election officials about maybe changing their procedures, if you have an example like that.
Yeah, I think one example that I gave, because it's just so simple to think about, was I was in poll watching in an absentee ballot processing center. You know, there's really just one place that they do that in Richmond. So I was there and I got to spend the whole day watching them, and they were very meticulous in signing in these ballots and opening them and feeding them into the machines. And they had two machines that were almost full, because those tabulator machines can only take so many ballots. So they are feeding ballots into the machine, and they probably got around 3,000 ballots in each machine, and then they started to malfunction. So they figured out what was going on, and they decided they needed to take the ballots out of the machines and, you know, set them aside so they could put more in. And so I'm just standing there on the side watching, and they stick the key in, they open the little door on the front of the machine, and it kind of burst open, and the ballots lie out onto the floor. And I don't think they were really expecting that. And instead of doing something there, they just went and opened the other machine, because it had to be empty too, and, you know, opened it, and it did the same thing. So then you have this like small mountain of ballots on the floor. And because they didn't really expect that to happen, a bunch of the paid election workers just came forward and started, like, they all just jumped down on the floor and started furiously trying to gather, you know, these things up. And they weren't really under the pressure of time, so it didn't have to be like that. They just were, you know, they were being cautious, and they were worried that all these ballots had dumped out. And I'm standing there, and honestly, I think they were worried that I was going to see, like, the way some of the people had voted on the ballots, which didn't really matter at that point, because it wasn't attached to a person. You were just watching what was happening. I was watching to make sure that they collected all the ballots, that some didn't get kicked under a chair or, you know, whatever, that they were assembling them. But I just was looking at all of that thinking, I don't think this is the way this is supposed to work. And so I went back and looked in the guidebooks of how do you empty a machine, and spoke to some other people in the state with way more experience than me. And, lo and behold, there was a whole process for how that was supposed to happen. And they were supposed to remove the ballots and they were supposed to count them to make sure they had the right number. And then they're supposed to be labeled and kept separately. The two machines are supposed to be separated in case there's some problem and they have to go back and recount them. They want to know which stack came out of that machine. So it's just an example of one of those things that you could see as a poll watcher. And the way they handled it wasn't the end of the world. The fact that they commingled them probably could have been untangled later, but there are processes for how these things are supposed to work. And after I went back and talked to that electoral board about what I witnessed, which they didn't know anything about this having happened, I just said, this is what I witnessed. This is what the code says. You know, it would be nice if we could go back and train all of the election workers so they know how to handle this, because in the moment they didn't. And the board was very appreciative that, you know, we had brought that to them and they were able to address that in the next training cycle.
Well, that's the thing that we have told people, citizen volunteers, for the last 2 years, that their job is to observe and document and report. And we, you know, it's interesting because that situation you describe, it's not that unusual. We've had a number of instances that have been reported where the election officials, when the observers who've been trained and who actually know, because we always tell them, go read the statute, go read the manuals, that sometimes they know more about what's supposed to happen than the officials do or the workers. And if you do it correctly, you can make a friend and become a resource rather than an adversary. And we've always said, I still don't understand why the media was so hostile to the idea of observers. It's in the statutes. It's in most of the states, but they were just so hostile to the idea of having observers. But our job is to observe, watch, document, report. And yeah, that's what you were doing, but you also became a resource. And that's the whole point of having citizen volunteers involved in the process.
Agreed. And if you build a good relationship with that elections board or your supervisor of elections, it can be a good relationship.
So you did all this work in Richmond, Virginia, and then, much to the dismay of the Virginia Fair Elections Coalition, Elizabeth moved to Florida. So tell us about when you moved. That was after the 2021 election in Virginia. And tell us about, is there still a functioning task force and group in Richmond? Did you leave behind a functioning group?
Good question, because I think it would be easy just to leave and have things fall apart. But there is a great functioning group in Richmond still. I think it was that process of meeting people that wanted to be involved for very similar reasons that I wanted to be involved, and figuring out what their strengths were, you know, and what their comfort zone was, and plugging them into roles on the task force that would be really good for them. You know, they kind of synced up with the amount of time that they had and their level of detail orientation and all of that. That was what I think really made a difference. And we had fun together. One thing that we did in Richmond that I think really made a big difference in growing the team was that we spent a lot of time reporting to this group of poll watchers and even poll workers what we had seen. Because I think it's very easy to see things and maybe they seem like small things and you don't share them with everyone. But some of the things that we saw were, you know, things that were not according to the state code. And some of the things were just, you know, areas where they weren't following practice, the proper practice. And then some things were just bizarre. And being able to report those things to that whole group then brings their level of knowledge up. And I mean, one example that I can give you of that is early voting in 2021. This is where Virginia had, you know, Virginia has moved to a model where you don't have to show an ID to vote in person.
Terrible.
And we had a poll watcher who saw a voter come in speaking with a very unusual horn-rimmed glasses. And they were speaking a thick accent. And when they came in the first time, they voted with no ID. They just, sorry, don't have my ID. And they had them fill out a form saying, you know, that they were the voter and you sign it under some kind of penalty. And the person votes. The second time around, this is 20, 25 minutes later, the same person comes in, same unusual horn-rimmed glasses. But this time, they're not speaking with an accent, you know, and they've changed their clothes. They're not speaking with an accent, and this time they have an ID. So you can't deny them the second time because they have the ID. And this was a very detailed poll watcher, not a highly experienced. You know, maybe they'd watched for a year or so. They hadn't been watching for 10 years. But it was somebody that I trusted to have reported that. And we did then we told that story to the rest of the state coalition in case this was a scenario where people are trying to learn how to basically cheat the system. That would be an example of the bizarre. But you see things. You see a lot of patterns and things that you can then watch more carefully for as you go through the election process.
Was there any way in a case like that to be able to challenge the first vote? Or is it just nothing you can do because no ID was required and that person just signed something and the ballot just goes into the mix?
Now, so they signed a form, you know, saying that they were the voter that they claimed to be. Which was different than their true identity, if this was, you know, if all of this is true and this really happened. So that paperwork you could get after the fact, you could public records request that and start to, you know, because you would know what day and time it happened and you could probably figure out which voter it was and start to piece it together. But it's so difficult because we aren't allowed to have cameras, which I think is a good idea. We aren't allowed to have cameras. And, you know, there are just limits on what you can do.
But even I think having the deterrent of being, if voters know that there's somebody they're watching, I think that's always a big help.
Yes.
But, you know, the big concern I always have is the unsupervised voting, but where the voting takes place away from the polling place without poll workers there, election workers there to help somebody through the process so they don't make mistakes. So then we don't get into all this curing after the fact because people make mistakes because they actually do need help when they're voting. And it's nice to think that they would be being helped by impartial election officials and not by political operatives who are at their kitchen table. But that's a whole different subject. But
I share your concern with that.
Yeah, yeah. So Elizabeth moves to Florida, and tell us about the move and what you've been doing with election integrity in 2022 in Florida.
So moved to Florida and moved to Broward County. And I had so many people at the Florida summit that said, "We need you in Broward. We're so glad you're coming to Broward." And I was really happy when I got to Broward to find that the parties, at least the Republican Party, maybe less so the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party was recruiting poll workers and poll watchers already. That was good. We weren't starting from scratch. And then there were other groups, like another big group called Defend Florida, that was doing a lot of work in voter rolls. Mm-hmm. So the fact that there was already an infrastructure of people that were trying to understand how the Florida process works and trying to get involved in different pieces of it, that was really good. That was very encouraging because we had, you know, a group of people to start with.
So tell us what you did. Tell us some of the things that you did and worked on and some of the things you found.
So, well, you know, there's a 101 and a 201 to having a task force is what I've learned. And everything we did in Virginia was the 101. It was that basics of recruiting people to go out and watch and to work as election workers if they're willing to do that. And then once you've done that for a cycle, all of those people come back into mm-hmm. your group and they have millions of questions.
Yeah.
So you spend that, you know, that first year, the end of that first cycle, just trying to understand what you saw and what part of it was legal and what part of it, you know, maybe was in the gray area. And, you know, how do you prioritize all of that? So that's like your 101 cycle. And we did that in Virginia and had great success because we found a number of things to really focus on in Virginia. But, you know, there were a lot of things we didn't see. We didn't see a truck of ballots pull up and in the middle of the night, you know, they're stuffing ballots in the back room. We didn't see that. So that gives people, you know, confidence, but they see the big gaps sometimes between what the state laws say and what's actually happening. So in Florida, I was happy to see there was an infrastructure. We started again in Broward, really with that 101 of making sure that we had enough people in polling locations just to have eyes on the process. And then a few of us attending canvassing board meetings and watching the vote by mail, you know, the unsupervised vote by mail voting, watching how that was organized and how it was counted, just to make sure that we knew what the laws were and, you know, that we understood what was happening. I can tell you that my first time through, so much of this has been a learning process because a lot of it is very, very different.
Oh, but you mean between Virginia and Florida?
Yes. I mean, so much, probably, I don't know, maybe 75, 80% of the code is very similar. And it's the same language. The language of the election is the same, if you understand what absentees right. are and tabulators and whatnot. But the biggest difference that I noted, and I kept waiting in Florida, where is this going to happen? Yeah. The biggest difference is that in Virginia, you have a one person who's in charge of a county running that election, but you have a board that sort of oversees what they do. Mm-hmm. And if that individual is experienced and knows what they're doing, the board doesn't have to do nearly as much. They're just kind of making sure that changes in voting places or the number of ballots that are ordered or new equipment that's used, that those things are overseen. In Florida, that director, that one main person is elected. Mm-hmm. And then they do all of the work of the election, setting it up and carrying it out behind closed doors.
Oh.
There is a board. They call it a canvassing board, but the main function of that board is to decide, they call it voter intent, but they decide absentee ballots or vote by mail ballots that come in and the voter kind of didn't fill up the bubbles the right way. They decide how that person meant to vote. And they spend hours and hours and hours doing that. And then later on in the process, they decide on provisionals and things like that. But the board in Florida does not go through and look at the reconciliation of the ballots to make sure that the right number of ballots were used. They aren't checking the work that's done in the precincts to show that, you know, everybody who cast a vote checked in, you know, that you've got the same number of check-ins as you have ballots cast. They don't check any of that.
Does anybody check that?
I kept waiting for this to happen. Like maybe it's the next meeting. It never happened. And then I went in Broward and there are a couple reports that they just make available to the public on their website. And I went and looked and those reports have a lot of interesting information, but they don't tell you down to the precinct, like to the machines at a precinct. Each local precinct will have, you know, 3, 4, 5 machines, and they don't tell you how the votes were cast on those machines. So,
Or even how many.
So, you can see the information at a precinct level, but you have to be able to check it down to the machine level to see if, you know, it was aggregated properly. Like, are all the machines there? Did all the machines report their information? We don't know. So I did do a public records request in for the primary, because I said, well, I can take my team in there and we can look at all the receipts that printed off the machines and see if it adds up to the right totals. And what I found out was that even though the code says all of that has to be made available for the public, they were going to charge me $500 to be able to come in and look at it. So, I mean, that's a significant hurdle for a citizen group. And you want to be able to do that at every election. So we didn't do that yet. We will do that
for the general election in every precinct.
Yeah. So that that surprises me that the canvassing board, which seem like they all seem capable, are there and spending a ton of time, but they're not actually looking to make sure that all of the machines came back in. You know, did all the thumb drives make it into the counting process? We're all just trusting that, I guess.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Elizabeth, because people say, oh, Florida is doing everything just perfectly well because we got the results that night on election night. And I keep saying, well, before we start praising everything about Florida, let's take a step back, because I'm really worried about the lack of transparency and the process of validating and verifying the identity of people who vote by mail in Florida. I mean, you and your task force, how much of that verification process were you as citizens even able to observe?
Well, in Florida, thankfully, after SB 90,
That was the bill that Governor DeSantis pushed through this in 2022.
That was 21.
Oh, that was 21. Okay.
They gave, they call them designees of either political parties or the candidates, or it could be the candidates themselves, have the right to go in and look at the signatures on the vote by mail ballots. So the signature is the main way that a vote by mail ballot is validated to have come from a particular voter. Like when you go in to vote in person, whether it's early voting or election day, you bring an ID to prove who you are. With the vote by mails, you have to have some personal information to request a vote by mail ballot. Mm-hmm. But then once it's requested, who actually votes it is the part that we're all nervous about. So we saw a lot of evidence of ballot harvesting.
Which is illegal under Florida law.
Well, ballot harvesting has different meanings.
Okay.
That's what I'm coming to learn, is ballot harvesting means different things. That the concept that you are going to vote your own vote and, you know, with minimal assistance, get it back to the supervisor of elections, that, you know, is how we envision things are working. But whenever you have third parties that are not the voter or the supervisor of elections going out and knocking on doors and asking to collect vote by mail ballots, or, you know, other things that we see that would indicate that one person filled out multiple ballots, mm-hmm. that's what we're calling ballot harvesting.
I see.
You know, so when in Florida, you have the ability, the whole public, you don't even have to have permission. Anyone from the public can go in and see the ballots that were open, these vote by mail ballots that were open, the actual marked ballots, and they separate them out by precinct and you can just go look at them. And we had somebody at the primary going every morning and looking, and they saw patterns. Like they saw, maybe 8 ballots in a row from this precinct, and they're all filled out with the purple marker, and they only voted the top 2 races.
Mm.
Well, that is ballot harvesting. Mm. That was somebody who filled out a bunch of ballots in a row. So, you know, we don't know who that voter is. But that's a piece of evidence that we've collected that, you know, we're planning to share that and a number of other things with the legislators so that, you know, they gave us the ability to go in and look at these things. I think, you know, they would really be interested to hear the results of some of these things we've seen.
Well, and we have to wonder, you're able to see the ballots, but you have to wonder who verified the identity on the envelopes as to where those ballots came from, because that's the first line of defense. And my view, listening to the work that so many of you were doing in Florida, is just that the sheer volume of mail ballots makes it impossible for citizens to have reasonable access to all of the process. And what I was hearing, and maybe you can clarify this, is that the supervisors of elections were allowing citizens to observe maybe an hour a day or 30 minutes a day of signature verification, but not the entire process.
Yes, it's nowhere near the entire process. In Broward, it was 30 minutes a day, every day. You can go in on Saturday and Sunday for that 30 minutes. And we tried, on nearly every day, we had somebody in there looking. But in a 30-minute window, if you're really, you know, if you're really fast and focused, you can probably see 50 or 60 signatures. So it just adds up to like a tiny percentage of, you know, it's probably around 1% of what we can see. And I don't think that's what the people think. The election office does 100% check, or they're required to do, let me put it that way, a 100% check on all of those signatures. And they will find envelopes that are missing a signature per se, you know, just for example. And those are going immediately to the cure. But the ones that they deem as acceptable, those are the ones that we get to see, the ones that they've already looked at. And we're finding, you know, things, we find signatures that don't match. And when we find enough of them, it's, you know, it's a flag that the supervisor's process isn't working well. And that's really the point of it, is for the supervisor to then go get the employees that are looking at them the first time to do, you know, a better job or a more thorough job. But there are locality, one of the issues in Florida is that each locality is sort of deciding for itself how this signature verification process will work. So if you go up to Palm Beach County, they use a machine to check the signatures, just like think about like a bank, a machine to check the signatures on all of the ballot, the vote by mail ballots. And it kicks out a lot of problem signatures because they have the intensity on it like dialed all the way up. So anything that's questionable will be kicked out. And then their board, there may be a secondary review process, but the board ends up looking at a lot of those. So you're just sheer odds of having your signature kicked out if you're in Palm Beach versus Broward is really different. And it's not supposed to be that way. It should be even. But just having watched in poll watching, the people, when you come in to vote in person, you sign that little, there's a little pad there, a little electronic pad that you sign your signature. And when people are signing it, they aren't paying attention to what they're doing. They're just like, okay, yeah, you know how you do at the grocery store when they tell right. you to put your signature, you just like maybe put your first initial and then drag right. it off.
Right.
That's what they do because they don't realize the importance of it. And so in signature matching, even with signatures that are valid, there's a possibility that you're matching against that precinct signature. And, you know, a signature where they took their time to sign it is going to look really different than what they did on that signature pad. So there's a lot of problem that comes up on both sides, you know, the potential of inconveniencing voters that, you know, it really is their signature, or, you know, the ability for people that are, you know, up to shenanigans to, you know, get fake voters through.
Well, you know, I think the legislature, didn't they order a study or request a study of what type of verification should be considered for voting by mail in Florida. Isn't that something that's supposed to be taken up by the legislature this next year?
I think the Secretary of State was supposed to come up with some guidance on that. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was related to kind of how to use the driver's license information in an effective way. I'm not sure if it was as broad as, what's the best way. I mean, what I would love to see is notarization to have, if you're so that each voter who votes a vote by mail ballot shows the same ID that you have to show in person. So you'd be showing it to a notary, but that's an extra level of protection for everyone that you've validated who you are. And then we can rely less on your signature.
Well, that's a good idea. Are you all going to be reporting to the Secretary of State some of your recommendations?
We are. That's once you've kind of gone through the 101 and figured out, where the code is weak, if you will, or could use tightening. Then we feel like it's our obligation to share that information with the legislators because they are on the ground like we are. They know a lot. They're, for the most part, very smart people, but they really, I think, appreciate it when you can come and give the specifics of, this is what you intended this to be, but here's how it plays out in real life. And here's the evidence of what we're seeing on the ground that it's being, used or misused.
Well, I think that you should have to show the same kind of ID to vote by mail that you have to show when you vote in person. And if that's a photo, government issued photo ID, having that notary signature work so that the person has to show that my driver's license, my government issued ID, in order to notarize it, or a photocopy of my government issued photo ID.
A lot of states do that. I think that would be into as well.
Well, something to make it harder to cheat, because that to me is where the big problems come. And I think about it not just in terms of the verification of the identity, but also the people who are the victims of these ballot harvesting schemes tend to be low income or the most vulnerable in our society that political operatives prey upon and take advantage of. So it seems to me that we ought to all be worried about those are the people who are most likely to have their votes stolen.
Yes. And because even if their votes aren't stolen, if undue pressure is being put on them to vote a certain way, because the person that's going to carry my vote and, turn it in is standing here waiting. And right. Oh, by the way, they're handing me a page with all the way I should vote, and then you feel pressure because, they're standing there watching you do it. What we have to avoid.
Now, I think the sanctity of the secret ballot should mean something. And that means for every voter, it could be a husband and wife. Maybe the wife doesn't want to vote the way the husband wants her to, or vice versa. In the final analysis, it should be a secret ballot, even in families.
Right. That's right. In families, you're going to talk to your spouse usually. And, a lot of times you see things the same way, but you should definitely sign your own ballot and fill it out yourself. Unless you are disabled and need somebody to help. And then the law allows for that. There are these assistance forms that are created just to handle situations like that. But I tell you, Cleta, I went to the canvassing board meeting, the last board meeting where they went through the provisional ballots. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there paying close attention and realized that there are 24 people flagged at this meeting who went to vote either at early voting or election day and were told that their vote had already been cast in the mail.
Oh, wow.
And when that happens, if you still want to vote, a lot of people probably just walk away at that point, frustrated. Right. But if you still want to vote, you cast a provisional. which in Florida means you have to fill out all of this paperwork and you sign saying it's a third degree felony and a $5,000 penalty. You're saying I have not already voted. Mm-hmm. But this is significant. It takes 20 minutes for them to do it. And then they're signing that. These are people who really meant it when they said they hadn't voted. And either those are people who maybe they're trying to game the system. They're trying to vote twice. They're people like that. So if so, we caught them. Or maybe they're people whose vote by mail ballots were stolen. That's who I tend to think it gravitates toward. There's another scenario, which is the one that the board chose. And the board decided to say, there was one board member who voted against it, but the majority of the board said they probably forgot that they had already voted.
And so they didn't count those ballots.
They didn't count any of them.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Elizabeth, because during the 2020 election, when I was working in Georgia after the election, we had hundreds and hundreds of reports to the hotline where people arrived at the polls only to be told, you've already voted. And I thought it was just something that happened in Georgia. And I'd never heard that before, 2020. And then I learned that people heard it in Virginia. And then I learned that people had heard that that happened all over the country in 2020. And I think that it has something to do with people, you know, sending out applications for absentee ballots and somehow getting absentee ballots in somebody else's name and voting that without the person even knowing. It's too widespread. It was too widespread for it to be that many people forgot they voted. Yeah. But I've always wondered what happened to those provisional ballots. How do you prove a negative? How do you come in and prove that you didn't already vote?
Well, we're going to find out because we've requested all the information on them. And we're going to, you know, attempt to untangle that and figure out.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But we're not going after the, you know, if there's an Alzheimer's patient in there and they forgot, like that's not who we want to know about. It's the ones that, you know, if they were gaming the system, there may be a few of those. But I think we're going to have testimony from people that can say my vote was stolen.
I think that's really terrific that you're staying with that because it was, as I said, it was something we heard over and over again in 2020, which is one of the reasons why Ned Jones and some people in Virginia in 2021 said, go vote on the first day in person so nobody can steal your vote.
Yes, that's what I'm telling people now as well, because also have we learned from Arizona that waiting till the last second is not good because Murphy's law, if nothing else, what can happen? You know, things happen. Don't wait till the second.
Well, Elizabeth, you are truly an American patriot and committed to doing what you can do now in two states, not just one state, to help address the issues in our elections and make them better and stronger so that we are protecting, helping people's fundamental right to vote to be protected. So on behalf of many, many millions of Americans, thank you for your service and your hard work and your dedication and your just sheer willing to persevere and to untangle those knots. That's really very much appreciated. And we thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you, Clea.
And thanks for joining us. That's the end of this episode of Who's Counting? We hope that you'll share this podcast with your friends and subscribe to all of the Apple, Spotify, Rumble. It's on YouTube unless they kick us off, which they've done from time to time because they don't like for us to talk about election integrity. So we count on our friends and supporters and true patriots to keep this going. So we appreciate all that anyone is doing for election integrity. We appreciate your listening. We appreciate your joining us, and we'll see you next time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.